All right. Let's get fired up here.
Maximum freedom. Read.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom.
Stay on target.
Maximum freedom. Read Rothbard.
Hello and welcome to the next episode of the Read Rothbard podcast. We've got big news, big things in the works right now. But before we get to that, I want to welcome Robert, my co-host. How are you doing there, Robert?
Oh, yeah. Hey, I'm back, everybody. What's up?
Doing it does great. Feel like it's
a little bit cold out here.
It feels like it's been a while since we've done a show, but it's really only been, 8 or 9 days. We do post about once a week, and the last show we were able to do actually a little bit earlier in the week, and here we are late again. But I think we maybe lose our edge sometimes when we let it go this long.
Well, we are really old, and there's a certain amount of ring rust that happens when you're out the game, you know. But yeah, you got to stay fresh. You got to stay on it.
Yeah, indeed. So we were going to talk a little bit about the movie Ratatouille, and I was also going to throw in this Morgan Spurlock movie called Rats, which I saw recently. And appropriately enough, we had some rats deal some damage at this homeowner's property, so we can get into all of that. But why don't we tell people what we do here at the Read Rothbard podcast, just in case they're not familiar, Robert.
What we do. Okay. Everybody listen in. Listen closely. What we do. We were a bunch of anarchists, and we believe in this kind of branch of anarchy called anarcho-capitalism. You could also call it voluntarism. It's where you pretty much just leave other people alone. And we analyze movies for their themes, issues, and instances of anarchy in those movies. Actually, anarchy surrounds us constantly, all the time. You're constantly making anarchist-type situation decisions all the time, where you're not appealing to some violent authority to decide what you should or could or can or won't do. You actually make decisions all the time. And we kind of point those situations out, and we also analyze movies from the perspective of the NAP, which is the non-aggression principle. Which is saying that you basically don't have the moral justification to initiate force against another human being. And as you'll see in this episode, it might take some interesting turns because we're actually dealing with some anthropomorphic characters. So it'll be interesting. Daniel might argue one way, I might argue another way. And that's the good stuff. That's the meat on the bone. Do you have anything to add, Daniel, about what we do?
That's a pretty good description. So essentially, yeah, that's what the podcast is about. It's taking the non-aggression principle, anarcho-capitalism, Austrian economics, and seeing a movie or some situation in the news, so something in the popular mind that we can see some of these themes within, and so we can discuss it. It's a good entry point into people who are not familiar with these concepts to maybe grasp them if they've not heard them before.
Indeed.
So let's get right down to it. We do have, like I was saying, some exciting things in the works. So hold on to your hats for the next couple of weeks. We're figuring out how to manage some of these ideas, but look for big, big announcements in the coming shows, coming weeks. We'll have some really good stuff coming out. I think it's going to be really exciting.
Indeed. Not to take away from what we're doing right now, because this show is going to be fantastic.
That's right. So let's get right into it. This show is about Ratatouille, the Disney Pixar film from, well, when is that, like 2008, something like that?
2007.
2007, all right. And it's got our friend Patton Oswalt as the main character.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say he's our friend because he's a great big Hillary fan. but Robert, you just recently watched this film. I also watched it recently with my kids. And so we thought it would be an appropriate one to do for the show. So why don't you give us the quick rundown on the show, and then we'll get into the different aspects and lessons that we can take away from it in a NAP, Austrian Economic Analysis.
Indeed. Okay, so Patton Oswalt stars as what is the guy's little name? I don't know. What's the little rat's name?
Remy.
Remy. So he is a rat, and he lives with his rat clan, which is basically run by his father. So he's kind of like the heir apparent in this kind of... he's like a mafia type, but it's not really clear if there's any kind of violence involved in the situation other than the theft, which we will get into. He stars, and they start out in this home. They're living in a house occupied by an old lady. And Remy has this special kind of power to be able to smell any kind of flavor or ingredient. His father actually uses him as like a poison detector because, rats get poisoned from time to time because they're pests. So they're in the house, and they're going to get chased out of the old lady's house. She finds a rat, and she is a very bizarre character. She sees a rat, and her decision to kill the rat is to pull out a shotgun and to destroy essentially her own home in the process of chasing away these rats. But anyway, it's a device that gets the rats out of the house and on with the plot. And so they escape into a kind of like a sewer system, and Remy gets separated from the rest of his family. And he washes up and climbs up out of a sewer in the middle of Paris. And he's super excited because he's a fan of the chef, which the old lady used to watch on the TV. And he's become this fan who says that anybody can cook. So his goal in life is to basically become a cook. Not just eat anything that his family loves to eat. They just eat garbage and whatever. They don't care. But he's like this kind of a snobby character that believes that food needs to be cooked the proper way and prepared and taste good. So Remy washes up, and he gets found by, he winds up in this in the actual restaurant of the cook he's a fan of. And throughout the movie, he kind of sees the cook as a hallucination, as a figment of his imagination. He kind of talks back and forth with the guy to keep up a dialogue in the movie going. So he's like, well, I got to check out this restaurant. This is your restaurant, even though he's dead, but he doesn't know that yet. At least I don't think he knows that yet. So he shows up, he goes into the restaurant, and the son of the famous chef is just getting a job in this restaurant. And he doesn't know how to cook, but, of course, Remy does. And through some hijinks, they kind of team up, and throughout the movie, it's actually the big conceit in the movie, the big, beyond the fact that rats are super intelligent and can cook and whatever, is that you can be controlled by pulling on your hair, like a robot or like a marionette. So our main character, Remy, controls this guy like a marionette and actually has him do all the cooking. And, of course, he's like this amazing chef. Everything he does is super delicious, and everybody's a big fan of his work. So the son of the chef becomes instantly like a new chef guy. He was originally hired on to be a garbage boy, but now he's promoted to chef or the cook. And the plot goes along that the main chef has there's a will coming up. A will, I don't know if you'd call it, but there's a part of the will that says that the restaurant goes over to his son at a certain point in time, or if he hasn't showed up by a certain point in time, it goes to the chef, the main chef guy, who turns into the kind of the villain of the movie. And let's see, there's a climax with a big critic who comes in, and I don't know, we can get into the different scenes and that sort of thing. That's basically how it goes. At the end, it's a big kind of... you have a goal, and you want to achieve your dreams kind of a movie. So it worked for me on that level. I enjoy any kind of story where there's a character that has a goal, and they're trying to achieve that goal, and then, of course, through a lot of hardship, they actually do finally achieve it. That gets me right where I live. Hang on, I'm choking up. So I know you had a bunch of things that we wanted to talk about. We can get into, is it theft for these rats? Because throughout the movie, there's kind of a debate going back and forth between Remy and his father about whether they're actually stealing or not from humans. Can rats steal from humans? Do they recognize property? At one point, they're eating garbage, and his father says, well, if nobody wants it, it's not stealing. But Remy is convinced that at any time they're eating any kind of human food or refuse, it is theft. So we can get into that. And there's also a kind of a feminism character who claims that there are some rules in place that make it impossible for women to be cooks. She's kind of like breaking the glass ceiling for this female character to be a cook, but it's never established or said what those rules would be. She's the only female character in the chef in the kitchen. And then there's also this evil character, the head chef character. He's seen as a sellout. He's taking like the good name of this cook, and has like a frozen food line, and that's somehow bad. We can talk about that.
Commercialization.
Yeah, you're selling out by having a line of food, frozen foods, because you know food is supposed to be prepared perfectly and purely, only for the people that can afford it on this level. You can't put out a lesser version of it to the supermarkets. There's other things we can get into. A lot of it's going to hinge on whether or not you believe that animals have any sort of rights or understand property rights. But let's get in. I know you had a list of things to talk about. So what do you want to start with? Do you want to start with your hatred of rats, your innate hatred and distaste for all things rodentia?
Yeah, well, I got a few quick stories, so we'll just let your little description of the film settle with the listeners for a moment, and I'll give you a couple of stories here. The rodents have been a big part of our life in the last 6 or so months. We go through our neighborhood on walks with our kids, and we started noticing that a certain corner, we would often see dead rats. And my daughter, for whatever reason, likes to see dead things. And so we started calling it the dead rat corner, and so whenever we go on a walk, she's like, let's go to the dead rat corner and look for dead rats. And on one occasion, we found some live rats, little babies, there in that corner, and they were, in the street, so they were going to get run over, and this was probably back in July or August, so it was a pretty hot day. And I couldn't bear to see them suffering. I didn't want them to get run over, so I carefully scooped them up and brought them home and tried to nurse them to health, inadvertently, I guess, cooking them in the process by putting a lamp too close to them to keep them warm. So apparently my cosmic karmic payback was that in the recent cold snap that we've had here, other rats, probably their cousins, have taken refuge under our house and decided to chew through the water pipes, the PVC water pipes, causing a leak. A spray, like a shower of water under our house for days. We didn't notice it for a while. We heard like a noise of like some kind of a humming, we thought it was an electrical noise, like a fan or something, going on for a couple of days, and we kept turning things off and saying, hey, do you still hear it? Do you still hear it? And eventually, my wife was like, hey, it sounds like water to me. Let's look at the hot water tank. Let's look under the house. And I look under the house, and they have chewed through the fucking water pipe, and it's spraying all over under the house. So we turn everything off, and let me tell you something. Being in the United States, even a poor person probably has access to water. As soon as you don't have access to water any longer, it becomes so vitally important. Like, you don't know it until you're missing it, how important it is. Like, we had laundry piled up, dishes piled up. We hadn't, topped off our water filter, all of these things that we sort of let slip by. Until you run out of water, you don't realize it. It's like a similar thing with electricity. Like, you don't realize how dark it really gets until you don't have power at night. these little guys had chewed through our pipes, and we had to get a plumber out here the next day. Fortunately, the free market provided a plumber for us so that we could get that fixed right away. That's a little bit of the history of rats for us. In the last 6 or so months.
So you went from being a rat murderer to being a rat murderer, and we're supposed to believe that you are objective when you were watching this movie?
Well, I tried to help the rats, and then they died, so I accidentally murdered them. I guess it, I mean, it's, was that negligent homicide of rats? And then they chewed through my pipe, so now I've got a bunch of traps down there. And yeah, I will kill those guys.
So when you were watching this movie, did it affect your enjoyment of the movie at all? Were you rooting for the rats to die at any point?
No, but when I did watch the other movie we're going to talk about, Rats by Morgan Spurlock, I was rooting for them to die.
Okay, so cartoon rats you're okay with, but real rats, you want them all dead.
Yeah,
unless
I'm sure they serve some purpose. They probably serve some purpose at some for some reason, but, you know, because they still exist.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, there's the kids' version, the cartoon version. I'm kind of okay with that. My kids, you know, enjoy that movie. But the Morgan Spurlock movie is downright gross. They travel the world looking at cities and areas where rats have become an issue, and the attempts for those cities to tackle those problems that the rats create. And, of course, it's all centered on, you know, what's the government's response? What's the city going to do about it? So they do New York City. They do Mumbai in India. They do New Orleans. And then another place in India where they actually revere the rats. It's a temple where people go and worship the rats. There's like 25,000 black rats that live in this temple, and the people go there and feed them and hang out with them. They consider them their reincarnated ancestors or relatives. It's really bizarre.
Yeah, they do that with worms, all kinds of life. Pretty much any life, what they consider to be like below human beings, some sort of a past ancestor, potential past ancestor. It's an interesting philosophy. It's fairly, when I watched it in 7 Years in Tibet, Brad Pitt was trying to build a movie theater, and they couldn't lay the foundation because every time they would stick the spade in the ground, they were worried about killing a worm. So they had to kind of very carefully, like just painstakingly remove all the worms from the ground before they could lay the foundation. It's an interesting philosophy that really paralyzes you economically, creates a lot of issues and problems for you.
Yeah, yeah. Because then the property is no longer yours. Like if you have to worry about the worms, right? You can't do what you will with the property you own.
Right? You share it with your ancestors. You have to respect them. Which, I'm fine with. Do it, man. They're so nonviolent that they won't even kill a worm. They're an ally as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I would support that. You know, anything non-coercive.
Yeah. So let's get into this movie before we start talking about your Morgan Spurlock propaganda film. Let's talk about the Ratatouille propaganda film and how did you have any issues with the conceit of the movie, or do we want to approach this from this anthropomorphic rat and obviously displaying intelligence? Okay, displaying intelligence to the humans. So then, if this character, this creature, is able to establish that they're sentient, ought we not treat them as if they have rights, right, and self-ownership, versus it's just a rat. Pest.
Yeah, when I was viewing the film, I sort of gave them the benefit of the doubt as this is the universe they've created to tell this story. And so they sort of play off of, you know, we don't expect to interact with rats on a sentient level, but in this story they do. So it sort of plays both sides of the fence on that. You know, so like all the humans pretty much treat the rats as we would in reality, like, oh, they're a pest, they're spreading urine and disease all over the place. So, you know, hence the old lady tries to shoot them with a shotgun, or the health inspector, you know, shuts down the restaurant because of them. The head chef, the Skinner guy, he wants to, you know, kill the rats and get them out of there. But on the other hand, yeah, this one particular rat is able to communicate, though he never speaks to, what's that guy's name, Linguini, the famous chef's son?
Yeah, Linguini.
Yeah, he just like nods or controls him with his hair. Like he displays like a awareness of and an ability to communicate in, I guess, a nonverbal fashion.
Right. He establishes intelligence by making human-like gestures.
Right. He nods or he says no, and then he, of course, helps him learn how to cook. Like one of the scenes is about him learning how to control Linguini's movements through his hair. So Linguini would be blindfolded and Remy the rat would be, you know, cracking an egg, doing a souffle, what have you, until he got good enough to where then they could go to the restaurant and have it appear that Linguini was this amazing chef when it was really Remy controlling him.
Now, did you have a problem with Linguini being a fraud? As in, they all assumed it was him making it. They all assumed that it was his talent. He kept telling them. I mean, he never, like, corrected them until the very end when he admitted that it was the rat. Did you see him as a fraud? Or is that a completely legitimate thing to essentially have this, be under the control of this rat to do your job?
Well, I think initially it was just a coordination, like a teamwork effort to do something that neither one could do on their own, and I was fine with that. But towards the end, once Linguini became the recognized heir and owning the restaurant, he started getting all sorts of press, and he took all the credit for it.
Right, but you could see that if he had said, oh, no, it's this rat, you could see how that would have destroyed the restaurant.
Yeah, I mean, that's eventually what happened, right? Like,
right.
The health inspector finally did end up shutting them down. And to that point, I wanted to mention that when Skinner was aware that Linguini was the son of the Gusteau character, and the will stipulated that if within 3 years or whatever the time frame was that the error did not become known, then the restaurant would go to Skinner. Skinner took effort to make sure that Linguini, A, didn't realize that he was the son, and B, that the restaurant would get shut down by the health inspector before some event, like some critic was going to show up and potentially revitalize the restaurant. And so there was a scene where Skinner contacted the health inspector department and was told, well, we don't have really time to get down there for, you know, the next few months, so you'll have to, you know, get back to us. So, you know, Skinner tried to use the government as a weapon, as a bludgeon, to shut down this restaurant, and then he was thwarted by the ineptitude, the bureaucracy that the health inspector's office was.
Well, okay, yes, that's all true, but if you were to go into a restaurant, and let's set aside his, like, vendetta against Linguini. If you were to go into a restaurant and you knew that rats were cooking the food or helping to cook the food, they were in the kitchen, period, would you not want to alert someone that this is the case?
Yeah, but I think his reasons were pretty much made clear within the film in the context that he wasn't doing it for those purposes. He was doing it to basically be a dick.
Sure, sure, but the end result's the same. I mean, regardless of what your motivation is. So do you still see him? You see him as a villain character? I mean, I only had a problem with him as a villain character up to the point where he actively knew that Linguini was the son and, you know, tried to keep that from him. Up to that point, I was perfectly fine with him being, you know, he was just a normal guy. I didn't see him as a villain character at all, even though I knew, obviously, as soon as you see him, you know he's a villain character. But I didn't have any problem with anything he was doing. I didn't mind that he had turned the Gusteau name or whatever his name is. It's not Gusteau, that's wrong. That's Beauty and the Beast. What's his name?
Gusteau.
I had no problem with him marketing Gusteau as a line of frozen foods. I thought that was perfectly fine.
Oh, yeah, me too.
Totally fine. But the movie sure made it out like, man, this guy's just the worst. And you are selling out the great Gusteau name, and you're destroying fine dining or whatever, and your name is Mud now. You've taken this noble chef and destroyed his name.
Yeah, you've commercialized it, commoditized it, and made, sold out the name, and you're a terrible person for doing so. But the reality is, if he was making a profit by marketing these materials or these products out to the masses, far more people could enjoy those things than otherwise would be able to just attend the restaurant, you know?
Right. Right, because this isn't like a chain restaurant where there's one in every town or one in every block. There's a single restaurant. It's in the middle of Paris. And we supposedly these frozen foods are going out nationwide or more so or all over Europe or who knows. We don't know. But far more people are able to partake in this food that obviously enjoy it for the price point that it's at than not. So I thought that was a kind of a needlessly demonizing the guy in the movie. Like, oh, you're selling.
Yeah, it was almost going after him for. Yeah, it was going after him for being a capitalist, right? For trying to be entrepreneurial and coming out with, like, new lines of product, and it was certainly trying to denigrate him. And that's one of the things that makes it kind of tough to watch some of these kids' movies and determine which ones we can share with the kids and not, because there's so many messages in a lot of them that are not appropriate, and not in the, you know, sex, drugs, rock and roll, swearing kind of way, but in the, you know, why would something like that be considered bad? You know, he's providing a service. He's providing value to potentially millions of people, and yet they're shitting on him for it.
Yeah. They're making him out to be the bad guy. In the end, yeah, I would say he probably was the villain character, but not for necessarily all the reasons that the movie tried to plant him as. So, so at the end, you know, the Linguini character, so at the very beginning when the rat is controlling the Linguini character, you don't think he has any obligation to tell anybody that he has brought a rat inside the kitchen, even though he's putting his fellow employees at risk by actively keeping a rat in the kitchen, knowing that that is a major health code violation, and even in a market, in a free market, there may be some sort of a health code that is kept up and maintained by consumer groups. And then you claim to be of a certain level of health, and you voluntarily allow people to come in and inspect you, and that's kind of like a gold star that you can put on your forehead. Look at us. We're keeping up with whatever. Because I saw it as a potential, he is threatening everybody in that restaurant with losing their jobs by having that rat on his head.
Yeah, you know, I didn't really consider it to that point. I mean, I was more looking at it as, well, it's in the script, right? And that's kind of one of our standby statements.
Right.
If he doesn't do that, then there's no story. Mm-hmm. Though I do agree that there would be, even in a free market, and probably more so in a free market, there would be health, I don't want to say regulations, but like self-regulating situations where things like that would be punished using market forces. Like critics are a market force, you know, if a critic goes in there and doesn't enjoy their experience or thinks the food isn't good, then that's going to disseminate out to the public and affect your sales and your you know, how many customers you're going to get. And one aspect I wanted to explore a bit with you was the whole concept of a government health inspector, which everyone knows exists, but as displayed in the film, are often not able to really be very effective, and it gives the public the false impression that, well, there's the public health inspector, so if the restaurant is still open, it must have passed these inspections. It must be safe. So it sort of makes people let their own guard down and rely on an inept bureaucratic process in place of what would, you know, potentially exist in a voluntary system.
Right. It creates a much lazier consumer, absolutely, because they will rely on this crutch of they believe to be. Now, one way you could take it, though, is, in this movie at least, is they show an overworked health inspector. Because the guy calls, and the health inspector's like, well, I can fit you in like weeks. Like, well, if anybody drops out, I can come by, but I'm so overworked and underpaid, and we're just underfunded. What we need is more money. What government does all the time is it fails forward. We can't do our jobs properly because we're underfunded. We need to steal more from the people. That's a constant refrain from government. So that's one way you could take this movie, is that they're showing this overworked health inspector who's just trying to do a good job, but he's all by himself in this whole big city, and he just can't get to it.
And I'm sure that was probably the intention of the filmmakers.
Right.
But as anyone who's familiar with bureaucracy and market mechanisms, they would realize that without competition and without an incentive to provide a better service at a more competitive price, without being able to provide the proper amount of resources, allocate resources to certain services and tasks and products that need to be created, and with no feedback mechanism, it really will never be a sufficient situation. You know, what is the incentive for a bureaucracy? Is it to go out and actually improve their processes and make sure that everything gets taken care of, or is it to make sure that their budget's bigger next year and that they have more staff?
That's right. Their incentive is to spend all the money that they stole from this year so that they can ask for more money next year, because they don't want their budget to be reduced, because jobs are at stake, because you got people to suck off of. Absolutely, man.
Yeah, sorry. I am in the middle of a super loud house. My kids are upstairs running around, so I don't know if you're hearing much of that, but I'm hearing tons of it. So, sorry, folks. That's what you get here on the Read Rothbard podcast.
You
guys talking. Yeah. Bunch of loud kids and rats chewing on pipes while we're talking about a rat movie.
Right. Let's talk about whether or not the rats were stealing. Because the mafia crime boss father character kept claiming that it wasn't theft. I mean, he saw it as... There's one scene where Remy is seen as kind of like bucking the system, like creating a new future. And his father takes him to this shop window where there's all these dead rats. And he's like, this is what humans do. This is the way of the world. What are you doing? We're rats. We do ratty type things, and they're humans, and they'll always be trying to kill us. And Remy's like, no, we're going to do a new thing. And, of course, in the end, Remy ends up being correct, and they make some new like ratatouille restaurant where it's still not clear what the deal is. I mean, there's a sign that shows a rat cooking, and the line is down across the block. I mean, it's out the door and around the block to get into this restaurant. Do the people know? The critic knows. He has been told that rats are running this restaurant or cooking in this restaurant. He has no problem with it. It's not clear whether or not all the other customers know. But I think in the real world, in like a free market world in here, if the best food in the world is cooked by a rat and everybody knew it, don't you think you might want to go check it out at least once? I think I would. I'd be like, holy crap, there's a rat that actually cooks. I mean, first of all, it'd be a complete novelty. And there would probably be windows. It'd be like going to, what's that donut shop where you see it, them all being made?
Krispy Kreme.
Yeah, Krispy Kreme, where you see everything being made. I mean, you'd want to go to the restaurant and watch these little rats cook. It'd be amazing. So from that end, I could see a Ratatouille restaurant doing incredibly well. Incredibly well. I mean, you'd probably think that they were like trained rats or whatever, but maybe they established their intelligence and it would be like this amazing news story and everybody would go. But we have, regulations passed down by the government that would prevent that sort of thing.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Back to the Morgan Spurlock movie, speaking of, you know, rats being disgusting and gross, there's actually a trade between Cambodia and I think it's Vietnam, where people will catch rats in Cambodia, transport them to the border, sell them to the Vietnamese, who will then prepare them as meals in their restaurants, and people will go and eat them. And they know exactly what it is. They know they're eating fried rat, tofu rat, or sautéed rat, or whatever, and it's like a delicacy.
Mm. Right.
There's a market for it. But yeah, back to your point about it would be a novelty to be able to see this. I certainly think that... In the universe of that this, or in the world that this film is in, that because Remy is controlling Linguini through his hair, there is a way to do it, I guess, sanitarily. You know, so like the rat is never touching the food; he's just controlling Linguini. I imagine that wouldn't necessarily cause any contamination or issues. Now, I think later on, when he's running the final restaurant, I think doesn't the rat actually do some of the stuff? And
big climactic scene, like all the rats, like the whole rat family is basically cooking all the food.
Right, right. Which if you watch the Morgan Spurlock one, and they talk about how rats leave a trail of urine wherever they go, that would pretty much disgust you. Like, do not watch both of these movies back to back, or especially the Morgan Spurlock one first, and then Ratatouille. Do the Ratatouille first, and then the Spurlock rats film, because otherwise it totally ruins Ratatouille for you.
They pee everywhere they go.
Yeah, they're constantly emitting urine to, I guess, communicate like a path to their fellow rat horde mates.
Mm. Nice. Yeah, so that would definitely change my opinion about a rat cooking in a restaurant if I knew that. Unless there was some way, I'm sure there would be a market force incentive for them to sanitize it somehow.
Yeah, and you know, the other thing about the Spurlock film, which is really, really gross, is the New Orleans scene. Is all related to this university that is catching rats and then testing them for what diseases they might be carrying. And some of them have, like, a bot fly and a bunch of other, like, terrible, terrible diseases. But the bot fly actually creates a hole within the rat, and the rat is still alive, and it implants its larva within the rat. And so there's this, like, gaping hole in the rat, still alive, where this bot fly larva is living, which is totally fucking disgusting.
Yeah, I've seen parasites like that, not in person, but, you know, on TV or in photographs, and that is horrifying. Some of the parasites that live in this world are so gross.
Now, was it you and me down at the river, you know, 20, 25 years ago, or was it Matt, where we saw this cat that had a hole in it, and it was, you know, still alive, still running around just like any old cat? It was probably Matt.
Yeah, it's probably Matt. No, I don't remember this.
All right. Well, hey. Never. Either way, that part's really, really gross. Apparently, rats are carrying all sorts of diseases. Of course, they're responsible for the spread of the bubonic plague, which led to the deaths of millions in Europe in the probably Middle Ages time. I don't really have that all that information in front of me, but I think what a quarter of the population died as a result.
Yeah, in the movie, they're shown as going into the dishwasher and then getting out of the dishwasher and then being all clean. With what I now know, that's still not enough for me. But you know, in this cartoon world, it was probably enough, so whatever. But yeah, gross. So Dan, let me ask you, what did you think in the debate versus the theft or not theft? Especially first of all, when they're eating garbage. First of all, when they're living in a human house unwanted. And then later on, obviously, when they're stealing from the restaurant, which seems to be an open case, open and shut case.
Yeah, so I didn't mean to duck that question and divert us into those other areas for the last 20 minutes. But regarding the theft, I think at the first part of the film, Remy's concerned about that they're stealing people's garbage. And his dad says, well, if they've thrown it out, they don't want it anymore, and it's not stealing.
Right.
But then Remy, shortly thereafter, then goes into the woman's house and is like, well, all the good stuff's in the house. You know, there's these spices and fresh produce and all of these things. So he's the one who actually takes it a step further. Like, initially, he's concerned that they're stealing garbage, and that's a problem for him. And then I guess he takes the justification from his dad that it's garbage and it's okay, they've given it up, and goes beyond that a few steps and says, okay, I'm going to go in the house and actually steal shit.
Yeah, I didn't get to that. He seemed to be, if he was going to be the hero character, like, hey, I think theft is wrong. But then, yeah, he sticks it up a notch and just robs the lady from her kitchen. What's that about? That's not a very consistent character there.
Right, and then later on, he is concerned about rats coming into the restaurant and stealing food from the refrigerator and the storage locker and all these things. But then something happens, I don't recall exactly what, but then he kind of gets talked into it by his rat brother or something. He's like, oh, okay, fine, you know, I guess it's okay.
Yeah, it seems to be like it's okay as long as they're hungry enough. Because that was basically their argument, hey, we're hungry, and you're working here at a restaurant. You've got all this food, so you should get it for us. It seemed to be a very much to each according to his own need kind of argument to me.
Yeah, it sounded like Eddie Vedder in that Temple of the Dog song, like, I don't mind stealing bread. Or is that Chris Cornell? But either one.
Both of them.
Yeah, they're both singing that, and it's like, I don't mind stealing bread from the mouths of decadence or something like that. Like, so yep. Basically, if you're hungry, go ahead and just steal from, you know, the rich people because
they didn't
apparently they've exploited you in some way by providing you services that have rendered them a profit.
Right.
And of course, you know, asterisk, crony capitalist excluded, right, which of which there are many in today's environment. But, you know, if they legitimately acquired their fortune, then, yeah, it's theirs, you know, like, you can't steal from them. They've actually provided tremendous value to many people in order to receive that compensation for their entrepreneurial risk they've taken on. So to think that you need to steal from them or that you're somehow justified in stealing from them is quite ridiculous and disingenuous.
Indeed. Why don't I take a quick little break, and I'm going to ask you this question before I take off. I've already asked it to you, but I want you to answer it as best you can. With their beliefs that, I mean, they clearly recognize that humans own property, yet they have no problem living in that lady's house, you know, like rent-free, just like destroying the property, whatever, even though she goes on to destroy it far worse than they did, apparently, or whatever. But isn't that kind of hypocritical there, dude? And I'll be right back.
Yeah, you know, I don't quite recall exactly at the beginning of the film if the rats were living in the lady's house or near the lady's house. Kind of a tough question because, I mean, there's, like I was saying, they are living on both sides of the fence. So if the rats are, as we would see them in reality, as pests that are taking up residence wherever it's warm enough or wherever there's a supply of food or shelter or water or garbage, you know, myself as a homeowner and who's had some destruction as a result of rats and also squirrels, I can tell that story another time. I will take steps now that I'm aware of them being here to get rid of them. So I invite the rats to go homestead another area, find another place to reside, and I think that would apply to the rats in Ratatouille. Now, when they go into the house, if they're not living there already, but if they go in to then steal from her kitchen, from her pantry, to steal the spices and the other foods, they're clearly trespassing and violating her property rights. Now, the fact that she then, in retaliation, takes a shotgun and starts shooting up her whole house is, you know, I think for dramatic and or comic effect, because it's, you know, it's a movie, it's got to be entertaining. I think any rational, normal person would just take steps to eliminate the threat that the rats pose and, you know, probably get an exterminator or put traps out, what have you. I mean, how we interact with animals, both domesticated and otherwise, I think is an interesting question. You know, in a lot of ways...
Right. This is a world where the rats recognize human property rights, sort of, but the humans don't recognize the rats' property rights.
Right, but the humans aren't aware that the rats are sentient beings that, that have an awareness of property rights.
Until later, until the end, right.
Right, and my wife is scoffing at us for having this ridiculous conversation, which I think is fine because I think it is ridiculous.
Right, well, if you were to believe, if you had the belief that all rats were sentient, I mean, I'm sure you would be taking different steps than you are now, or would you not? You would still say, hey, they're rats, they're chewing up my shit. Or would you say, hey, these rats are sentient. They have property rights, they own themselves. I have no right to aggress against them. Even though they are aggressing against me by chewing up my shit, it doesn't justify murder. So I'm going to take steps, other steps.
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting point you bring up. I think that once you're aware that, that something else is sentient, and this is, of course, you know, taking it kind of crazy.
Well, we were talking about it a little bit with our AI episode.
Right, yeah. So I guess once you're aware of another being's sentientness or ability to understand, and they're doing something that you don't want them to do, I think that you would be best off to attempt to communicate with them and let them know, like, hey, this is an issue for me, and since I now know that you are aware and I can communicate with you that this is an issue, like, you need to stop doing this, then, you know, that would be the first attempt at resolution. I think that murdering them would be very, very far down the line from there.
Right, yeah, there was a news story just I saw yesterday where, like, this 84-year-old man just shot and killed a lady who was out looking for her dog. Now, I don't know if she knew she was trespassing on his land or not, but it's strange that your first compunction when dealing with a sentient creature, that even though they're trespassing, they don't appear to, I mean, you don't necessarily know that they're necessarily a threat or not, but your very first instinct is to just shoot to kill right off the bat. It seems a bit extreme.
Yeah, I think the standard, at least in the current legal framework, is that there needs to be an immediate and very clear threat to body or person before you can undertake a self-defense, you know?
Right.
Like, especially with lethal force. So, yeah, it's sort of, at least in today's framework, you know, an incumbent on a person to make sure that there is that threat and to communicate with somebody who's you know, violating their property or whatever prior to engaging at that level. And I think that would play out also in voluntary society. I don't think that people would last very long in a society where their first instinct would be to shoot somebody just for being on their property. I think that would be a ridiculous way to interact with other individuals, and I think there would be repercussions for that in a voluntary society.
Yeah, I would think so as well. Certainly wouldn't engender having many visitors or friends. I mean, I think that person would, could, and should hear it from anybody and everybody they know, even if there's no kind of legal action taken against that person for that killing, to let them know that, hey, this is not cool. This social norms are a real thing, and to just reach for the shotgun as soon as anybody steps on your property is on the ridiculous side. I mean, We're probably taking the story a little bit out of context, so that we don't know all the details, and context is very important when dealing with deciding whether or not, you know, aggression has occurred or not. But in the general sense, if you just reach for violence for every little thing, there would, in a free market, I think there would certainly be if not outright ostracism, but there would be some sort of repercussion.
Yeah, I agree. So to recap some of the things we've discussed so far, before I think we should start winding this down.
Yeah, just for a second, you got real quiet all of a sudden.
Oh, sorry. How's that? Is that better?
That's way better, yep.
Okay, so before we start winding down, I just want to go over a couple of things we talked about in relation to this movie. We've talked about critics being a market force, so they can certainly affect whether a restaurant is going to be successful or not. Health inspectors and how it sort of gives the public a false sense of security that this issue is already taken care of and therefore I don't need to be as concerned about it. The bureaucratic nature of it, the no drive to improve other than improve their budgets. We've talked a little bit about taking a natural talent, like Remy had a specific ability to be able to smell or taste something and know all the ingredients that were in it, and he decided to use that to his advantage to be able to craft something that was better than what the given ingredients were and make something great. We also talked a little bit about the fraudulentness of Skinner, the head chef, trying to keep the rightful heir of the restaurant in the will from getting the restaurant. And we were going to touch a little bit on the female character. You talked about her a little bit. I think her name is Colette. And she sort of displayed some harsh feminist point of attack against Linguini when she was tasked with showing him the ropes in the restaurant. Like, she got really mean with him and was like, I got here where I am through hard work, and I overcame all these rules put together to keep me down by stupid old men. And she got all jealous of him getting some attention and thought that Linguini was trying to use her to, like, as a stepping stone to basically surpass her and not recognize her contributions to helping him learn how the restaurant functions and things like that. So it just seemed to be like this token 5 or 10 minute portion of the film to basically play to the SJW crowd, to the pro-feminist crowd. And I think a lot of movies do that these days. I mean, the new Ghostbusters was basically, 88 minutes of that. Fortunately, Ratatouille is only 5 or 10 minutes, but you want to just talk about that a little bit, and then we can start to wind the show down.
Yeah, like you said, more and more movies seem to trot out to these like feminist tropes and just like kind of cram them in to movies for almost no reason. Was it important to the character? It kind of explained her feistiness, and they wanted to give her kind of like this fiery personality. So she's like a woman making it in a man's world. It would have made more sense if they had explained at least one or two of the rules that she was talking about. But at the same time, there's nothing stopping her from starting her own restaurant. If there were, in fact, rules in place to prevent or to, create greater hurdles for a female chef as opposed to a male chef. But she just claimed that there were, and she was the only female, and of course she played like the big kind of victim. She had to work extra hard. And there's a lot of those kind of movies where the woman has to create, work extra hard to fit into a man's world. Like Zootopia, G.I. Jane, I don't know, just off the top of my head, there's a bunch of them. It's never quite clear, but it always seems to be a woman trying to fit in with, into quote-unquote a man's world. Well, what's stopping you from creating a woman's world, creating your own organization, creating your own business, and then hiring who you see fit? And if you want to create some kind of a woman world, what's stopping you? The whole kind of trope kind of rings false for me on that level. The same barriers that prevent me from starting a business prevent a woman from starting a business. It's not anti-woman. It's just anti-human. It's this protectionism from governments to protect the entrenched, you can call it an oligarchy, you can call it crony capitalism, call it whatever you want, but it's not necessarily a sexist thing. In fact, I would argue that there are far more sexist things against men in today's modern Western society, not necessarily in other societies, but at least in the world we live in the country we live in. Men are drafted into war. Men are rarely win custody battles. Men pay vast majority
child support.
Child support, thank you.
Alimony.
Men are the vast majority, yes, alimony. Men, the male numbers of suicide are far greater than the female numbers of suicide. It's just the disposable male doesn't really get talked about a whole lot. And being a man, it's kind of important to me. So maybe if more of those tropes showed up. But it's seen as a man's world and men run the world and blah, blah, blah. And so you're supposed to just suck it up and, you know, not talk about it. And you're supposed to be like this, you know, whatever, pro women, rah, rah. And any time that there is some kind of violent institution, violent law that unjustly attacks one person, well, all laws are violent, unjust things, but yeah, there's going to be injustices. It's not necessarily anyone trying to attack women. But anyway, as far as the movie goes, I thought that, you know, she was like the love interest. So Linguini ended up falling in love with her. They get together. And then he does attribute all his success to his attraction to her, like wanting to be good cook for her. And that's what he tells the press, as I recall, when in actuality it was the rat in his head, or in his hat. But I have no problem with her as a character, as like a fiery, spicy love interest. I got no problem with that. But her like resentment towards some unknown rule, it didn't really play well for me. What were your thoughts, Daniel?
Well, I think that it might be funny that there's an irony in that a lot of the laws and regulations that are put into place, like affirmative action style things or challenges in firing people who are, you know, women or minorities or whatever, these regulations and things that come into play, if she did want to do what you suggest, which is to go create her own restaurant where she only hires women, she may be at the barrel end of these very same regulations that she would have supported to be put into place. And she would find that they would prevent her from hiring who she wanted to hire, and she had to fill certain quotas or, you know, what have you, whatever the regulation stated. And it would be, you know, kind of like I was saying, a rich irony that she doesn't now have the freedom to voluntarily go out and create that women's restaurant if she wanted to.
Through the own policies she would, yeah, support. Indeed. Yeah, oftentimes when you vote to put a gun in pointed at your neighbor, it ends up also pointing back at you.
Yeah, exactly. And like you were alluding to, like every law is a lifted gun. Like that is the driving force behind it. Like if you violate that law, then eventually, you know, you scale it far enough where you resist it enough, they will bring guns to bear.
Yeah. They have to control the situation. If you flout their laws, well, then they aren't seen as the rulers anymore, right? So they have to enforce that shit. And if you resist and don't recognize them as your rulers, then they will escalate things to the point at which they will kill you. So
on that happy note, why don't we wind the show down on that happy note?
Yeah, Ratatouille. What do you think of this movie, Daniel? Would you give it a 2 thumbs up?
You know, I think it's an entertaining movie. My kids liked it initially because it had rats in it. Like, that was one of the reasons we bought it, was because they saw a screenshot of it, and they're like, oh, there's rats. We want the rat movie. After watching it once or twice, they actually now prefer the dinosaur movie far more. For whatever reason, I think it's because the dinosaur and the kid in it howl like wolves, and they like to do that.
The good dinosaur? Is that what we're talking about?
It is the good dinosaur, yeah. They love that movie.
All right. I heard it's dark. I heard like the dad just suddenly dies for no reason.
He gets swept away in a flash flood in a canyon. So, yeah. Yeah, and my 1.5-year-old, she freaks out every time that happens and needs to be picked up, but then she likes the rest of the movie. But it's basically been on repeat in our house for the last 2 weeks.
That's what it's like being a parent. Repetition.
Yep. And as soon as it ends, they're like, play it again. Or if, for whatever reason, we've had to like turn off the movie like mid-movie, the next time it turns on and I'll like pick up where it left off, my 3-year-old says, no, start at the beginning.
Oh, yeah.
And they never get tired of this. It's great.
Yeah, good times. So, yeah, I thought the movie was pretty good. Other than a few reasons that I mentioned, I love a good story where you're like an entrepreneur and you have a goal and you fight through all these obstacles and you achieve that goal. That gets me every time. So in that sense, it was very successful. I thought that the villain wasn't super villainous, but whatever.
Yeah, I mean, until he tried to prevent the rightful heir from getting the restaurant. But yeah, I agree. The message of honing your craft, getting really good at something, specializing, creating value for others was really good, and I liked that part of the movie. The little feminist thing in there I didn't really care for. And that the health inspector, I mean, they did treat him sort of as a they didn't treat him with a whole lot of reverence. Like, when he eventually does show up to the restaurant, the rats kidnap him and lock him in the freezer.
Right.
And only after letting him out, then, of course, he shuts the restaurant down. So, I mean, in that respect, you know, I was kind of okay with that part.
You're okay with them kidnapping him and locking him and throwing him away in the freezer?
It didn't really bother me too much. I mean, on a principal level, yeah, they shouldn't have done it, but it was only temporary, and I don't know. I kind of give them a pass. They're animated.
Right, right. Yeah, it was like it was in the script. They needed the health inspector to not interfere with the big climax of the film where they cook this ratatouille dish for the big critic. So, but yeah, it obviously, I don't know. Would you say that the health inspector was aggressing against them and that they're self-defense? I don't think you can make that claim.
Well, if you argue that he would shut them down, and if they refuse, they would bring guns to shut them down, then yeah.
Well, he would shut them down in that they were rats cooking food for human consumption. And those human beings did not know that they were eating rat-prepared food. So they were perpetrating fraud on their customers, were they not?
Yeah, I think you could argue that. But, I mean, health inspectors will shut down a restaurant for – there's a story here that I see that a shop in Brooklyn, a bagel shop, got fined because his poppy seed and sesame seed bagels, some of the seeds fell on the floor, and they shut him down for
that. Yeah. Oh, yeah, well, hey, I've got no love for any kind of government service. You know this. I would much rather if there was some sort of, you know, a free market solution where if there's some sort of a health, you know, level that restaurants voluntarily adopt or openly, you know, hey, we subscribe to the 2-star level of health and our prices are cheaper or whatever. You know,
yeah, or you've got Yelp or review systems, Yelp and whatnot, right? Like, there are ways to have third-party arbitration of, the cleanliness or the quality of any establishment.
Right, and you are, you know, as a customer, you are taking a risk. You're accepting a certain level of risk. You're not guaranteed, you know, a guarantee is no, my brain.
Well, you know what, that's a decent spot to cut this
one
down.
No, that's not a good stop. No, I was going to make a point. Let's say that, you know, a restaurant would voluntarily let in a health inspector type person in a free market, and they could flout that. You know, they could say, hey, we're so transparent. Feel good when you come to this restaurant. You're still accepting some level of risk, but you're not accepting a great deal of risk, whereupon you could go to another restaurant who don't let in health inspectors. And you know that ahead of time. You can see that they don't let in health inspectors. So you're taking a larger risk. And that's a market choice that you could make. So I could see both of those things being viable, although one would be far more preferential. And I think there would be an incentive for restaurants to be more – to want those kind of accolades, you know, those kind of gold stars, to be able to advertise that to their customers.
Yeah, there's actually whole businesses built around that, like ISO and Zagat and like Diamond Ratings. There's a whole bunch of things that companies will voluntarily go through this process and pay big money for it to get certifications that they can then flout. And
right.
Many times, like in business, especially in some of the work that I do, your company has to be ISO certified or has to have certain designations and certifications that are voluntary. They're, you know, free market style, not government style. And even Underwriters Laboratory, like UL listing for a lot of the electronic things that people will buy, is a private thing. And I don't know if it's as important in the climate that that we live in today, where people sort of just expect that because there's government regulations that things are just taken care of. But I imagine that UL listing is seen as valuable to the companies that go through with it versus the ones that don't.
Certainly. Certainly. And without government regulations, yeah, there would be a much more, I don't know, considerate consumer, a much more vigilant consumer, and they'd probably pay more attention to those sorts of things. But even now, yeah, like you said, there are like Zagat ratings and certain certifications and whatnots that are, if not enforced by law, that you must have them. Essentially, people won't do business with you unless you have these certifications, and that's a completely voluntary thing.
Yeah, exactly. And we go through that all the time with RFPs, like, you know, what are your certifications? Are you ISO this? Are you Six Sigma that? And if you're not, you know, it's a big factor in whether you get the business.
Right. Indeed. Good discussion.
Yeah, so let's wind this one down. I think I've said that a couple of times already, and I'm not teasing anymore. Let's do it.
Oh, for reals now.
So as we were saying at the beginning of the show, we've got some big announcements in the works, coming underway anytime in the next couple of shows. Keep an ear out for what we do come up with. We've got great ideas, just strategizing on how best to implement them is sort of the issue right now. But big things are on the horizon. We are presently, and this is a big clue, everyone, we are presently known as the Reed Rothbard Podcast. We have books, lectures, articles, and this podcast at reedrothbard.com. We've got all sorts of affiliate links, Amazon, Read It. For.me, Liberty Classroom, all over the website. If you do want to support us in any way, click on any of those or on our tip jar page. It's in the top left corner of readrothbard.com. We're on Patreon, we're on YouTube, we're on iTunes. We're now on Stitcher. We're all over the place, so support us where you can. Give us a review, a shout-out, a like, a smoke signal, whatever you got. We'll take it. We appreciate you being a listener, so thank you very much.
Indeed. Take care, everybody. Have a good one. We'll see you soon.
Bye-bye.
The Chipmunks. C-H-I-P-M-U-N-K. We're the Chipmunks. Guaranteed to brighten your day. Do, 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 do.